That's...
Welcome to the second hour of the John Rothman program. I'm delighted to have as my guest in studio one of my favorite writers, Jim Smith. He's been here before. You've heard him talk about Playland and a number of other subjects, but he is here tonight to talk about his new book, co-authored with W. Lane Rogers, who passed away recently. So Jim is carrying the ball on this book. The California Snatch Racket, Kidnappings During the Prohibition and Depression Eras. Now, Jim, I got to ask you the question because everyone is riveted on Los Angeles and the trial that is going on there. Is it unusual for people to become preoccupied with these events?
Oh, absolutely not. The media loves to play up to it, number one. I mean, here we are. I mean, we're talking about it. But from the earliest times, when the newspapers carried the day, they would literally work people up and get them excited about these cases. If they didn't have a story about it, they'd make up a story about it.
And provocative headlines, of course. Let me ask you then, let's jump right to it. Amy Semple McPherson. Boy, she had the power of God, didn't she?
Oh, absolutely. Founder of the Four Square Church and Angelus Temple down in L.A., and she had great followers. They built that temple, $1.2 million, and didn't owe a dime by the time that thing was built.
And what year was that?
Donations came in. That was about 1923 that thing was built.
And that was a lot of money.
Well, that was a lot of money back then. You know, now, it was tremendous.
Now, she's a great evangelist, and everyone loved her, and all of a sudden, she vanished.
That's right. She went out for a swim. She was at Venice Beach, staying at a hotel out there. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, she's swimming out there, and she doesn't come back. And they think, my God, she's drowned. Her mother was called Mother Kennedy. And she put out a reward, $500 for her body. So they spent days looking for her. Every member of Angelus Temple was out walking the beaches looking for her body. Nothing showed up.
Where was she?
Well, good question. Pretty soon the police did, well, actually, newspapers. Let's talk about newspapers for 2 seconds here. Every newsman, every reporter was a detective. And one reporter from the L.A. Times noticed that her radio engineer was missing as well. And he says, oh, something is up.
Excuse me, a radio engineer was missing?
Can you imagine?
Anthony, are you listening? A radio engineer was missing. Go ahead.
Yeah, so anyway, they started thinking, well, maybe there's a little foul play here. All of a sudden, there's $25,000 reward being offered for Amy McPherson live. So they're thinking now she's not dead, she's been snatched. And the term snatch racket came from an earlier kidnapping where the term first hit the newspapers where one guy said the snatch racket just ain't profitable anymore. But they started looking and they couldn't find her. So they said, okay, well, with this reward out, they were seeing her everywhere. They were seeing her up in Fresno. They were seeing her in... of course, San Francisco and all over. They saw her in Carmel. She was gone for a month, and people were just wondering, you know, what's going on. Meanwhile, the newspapers kept beating the drum, and they kept having services at the Angelus Temple to bring her back. And if she came back in X number of days, you know, I mean, if she was dead, that's okay. She'd be raised. So I mean, it was amazing. All of a sudden, she comes wandering out of the desert a month later and is taken to Douglas, Arizona, where she has this wild story about being kidnapped by men and hauled down into Mexico and tortured and being held for ransom, $50,000 that they were expecting from her mother. She escaped they had left her, and she found an old varnish can, she says, cut the ropes that were tying her from the lid of the varnish can and walked out of the desert.
Stunning, but not true.
Well, who knows? So there were people, you know, they brought her in, and right away, the news again was doing the research, and they caught this bellboy, and they had a picture of Ormiston, who was the
radio engineer.
Radio engineer, yes, indeed, and so they showed him this picture, and the bellboy says, well, that guy checked in about 2 days ago. Well, by that time, he was gone. And then the word got out. Somebody says, well, gee, that guy and somebody that sure looked like Amy Semple McPherson was in this little love nest in Carmel in a little cottage.
Scandal. Well,
oh, let me tell you, it was scandal.
This book is loaded with scandal. It is The California Snatch Racket, available on the KGO bookshelf at KGOradio.com. When we come back, you guys who live in San Jose, we're going to tell you about a lynching and a governor of California by the name of Sonny Jim Rolfe. My guest is Jim Smith. His book, The California Snatch Racket, available on the KGO bookshelf at KGOradio.com. It is filled with wonderful stories. Okay, Jim, a man named Thurmond, a tree in San Jose, and the governor of California, Sonny Jim Rolfe, and a lynching. Tell us about it.
Okay. Let me tell you. Some of you who are from the old times in San Jose remember the Hart Department Stores. Well, the son of the owner of the Hart Department Store got his picture taken on November 9th, 1933. And this was, he was being raised up to the next position in the store. Everybody liked him in town. He just graduated from college and was moving on. And so he got that picture taken. He was snatched. His car, he was running his car down the road. He was snatched by a couple of guys and hauled off. They didn't know what happened to him. There was no ransom note. The family just found they disappeared. At first, they didn't worry. They thought he was off with his friends. But he wasn't. What it turned out, at first they says, okay, well, it's got to be the gangs. Everything was the gangs, the mafia, the mob. The newspapers wrote that Pretty Boy Floyd had snatched him because he was in the area, and they knew that he'd done it. Then they said it was Handsome Jack Clutus. You notice how all these guys have these fancy names. That was the newspapers.
Well, they don't call me names. Handsome John Rothman for nothing.
That's true. Yeah, well, the radio's doing it now. It used to be the newspapers. You know, we've taken them over. It was neither one of those. It wasn't organized crime. It was disorganized crime. In this case, they got their first ransom demand, which was totally stupid. These guys didn't know their target. They called the father of Brooke Hart, the guy who was kidnapped, and they told him, you get in your car and you drive out here by yourself and you bring the ransom and you can have your son. Well, what they didn't know is the guy didn't drive. He had no way of doing it. So there was nothing he could do. They'd called the police. The police were listening in. They said, okay, we'll wait till the next time around. They waited till the next time around, and they nailed him. They were able to trace the call. This was 1933, and they'd finally figured out how to trace calls. We'll talk about that maybe a little bit later.
We will. It's a great case. Go ahead.
Okay. So anyway, they caught these guys, and they says, okay, where is he? Well, they hadn't really done right by the guy. They decided it was too much trouble to keep a captive. So they took him out to San Mateo Bridge. They had him bound with baling wire. They hit him with a brick. They dumped him off the bridge. When he was screaming underneath, they took a pistol out and tried to kill him by shooting him. So he was dead. And the town was furious. But beyond that, the newspapers started working him up. San Francisco Examiner said that the crowds were gathering there for a lynching. Now, there were no crowds yet, but believe me, when people got the idea, they decided, hey, that's the thing to do. So the sheriff down in San Jose says, okay, let's move them back up to San Francisco where they're first arrested. They moved them back up to San Francisco, kept them up there until they found the body. When they found the body, this was in the mud flats just off San Mateo Bridge over by Mount Eden and Hayward. At that time, they says, okay, we're taking them back. We're going to try these guys. They brought them back, and the newspapers again said the crowds are gathering for a lynching. There were 10,000 people around the jail at St. James Park, and they were ready for them. So what happened was they, once they were inside, these guys rushed the jail. They took some huge steel pipes. I mean, these were the type of iron pipes you use for sewer. And they literally broke the door down. They only had about 20 sheriff's deputies in there, not enough to take care of these guys because they were coming in the hundreds. They pulled these guys out kicking and screaming. They also start to pull out some of the other inmates, but give up on them. They decide it wasn't worth that. They pulled Thurman out and stripped him. Was he the one stripped? I don't remember. Anyway, one of them they stripped him. One of them they didn't. But both of them they hauled out to the trees, and they beat the tar out of them for about 15 minutes till somebody brought some ropes. They threw the ropes up over these trees, stretched them up, and hung them. Now, this isn't a hanging where you break the neck. These guys were strangling. I mean, their faces were turning black and whatnot. Holmes, on the other hand, fought it. He kept grabbing the rope from the top because his hands weren't bound. He tried to pull himself up. They beat the tar out of him and do it again. The third time, they finally hung him.
Thurman, by the way, is the one who was stripped by the crowd.
Right.
And there are pictures here. Now, explain Sonny Jim Rolfe's role in all this.
So, after this all happened, you know, some of the people were aghast. But Sonny Jim says no. He says, forget it. People will learn not to kidnap in the state of California because we know how to deal with people like that.
What he said is no kidnappers will ever be turned loose on or pardoned while I'm governor, but they'll learn they can't kidnap in this state and get away with it. Kidnappers will find they aren't safe, even in our penitentiaries. Okay, a pair of kidnappers who thought phoning their ransom demands from a payphone would protect their anonymity. Sounds like a great idea.
Well, it's a wonderful idea. 1921, if you were going through the phones, you went through multiple operators to get to one line, and they had plug boards. And so once they plugged it in, they were off the line, and that was done. And that was about as anonymous as you could get. It was perfect. So these two guys, the Carr cousins, Jack and Floyd, snatched Mrs. Gladys Witherell in Hollywood. They left a ransom demand for $50,000 and hauled her off to some ranch house up in the hills. They figured, hey, this is going to be the perfect crime. We'll use the phone to call in our demands. They changed their mind quickly and dropped another note off in the mail for $30,000. And nobody knows why they changed their mind about the $50,000. Maybe they figured out the guy didn't have that much money. In fact, he was only a bank clerk and had next to nothing. He couldn't afford it. So he had called the police, and the police were figuring, okay, the guy does have a phone. So they put a second line on that phone and said, let's see if we can get back and figure out some way to do this. So they got together with all of the phone operators in the area and says, can you trace this call back? And they says, yes, we can figure out a way. So these guys, they finally decide, okay, we're going to call in and we're going to get a drop set up. They call in, and when the call came into that house, the operator stayed on the line long enough to make sure it was the kidnapper. At that time, then, she calls the station that she'd gotten the call back from and says, okay, you just plugged into me. What plug is that? And that one says, okay, this is this one, and I got it from so-and-so. She looked at where it was coming from, and they started trading that thing back to the main station, then went from the main station out to where this thing was in a payphone. They held this guy on the line for 14 minutes, and by 14 minutes, the cops were there to pick him up. And they literally asked him, who are you talking to on the phone? And he knew he was had. So that was the first recorded phone call trace, and that was done in 1921.
I love it. Now, I've got to ask you something. I've always wanted to plot the perfect crime, the perfect murder, okay?
Yeah.
From a purely academic point of view, can you describe two the UC Berkeley students who attempted to plot the perfect crime and what happened to them?
Oh, of course. You're talking about Bliss Baker and Russell Crawford.
I am two brilliant young men.
Oh, absolutely brilliant. A little strange. And they were fans of Nietzsche. They were supermen. They were smarter than anybody else, and they could plot the perfect crime. So they had looked at the crime that happened earlier. This was in 1925, during the Jazz Age. But in 1924 Chicago, Leopold and Loeb had committed a horrible kidnapping. They had caught a teenager. They asked for $10,000, but they chopped him up into pieces and went out to dinner. I mean, these guys just thought they were wonderful. So Baker and Crawford thought we could do it better, and we could do it without ever touching a person, without harming anybody, and we could come out with $50,000 because we're five times as good as those guys are. It was a great plan. they decided, okay, who are we going to kidnap? They had to get a wealthy person. And so the best person they could think of was Daniel and Virginia Jackling. They were going to snatch Virginia. Now, if you know the Top of the Mark in San Francisco, okay, that's a great club, right? Before it was a club, it was the home of the Jacklings. They had, that's right, they lived there. They had that thing built out by the Mark Hopkins Hotel, and that was their residence. So, of course, they had phones and everything there. I mean, they were, you know, 1925, they were modern. It was the perfect way to do it. So Baker and Bliss called Virginia after they assumed that Daniel had gone to work because he was a copper magnate and he had to run his business and he worked in downtown San Francisco. They called him up, called her up and says, your sister's been in an accident. You got to come to San Mateo right away. Meantime, they got a cabbie to drop off a note into the office of Jackling and tell him that she'd been kidnapped. And if he didn't give them $50,000, they were going to inoculate her with a horrible disease that she would die a terrible death from. Well, that was all well and good, except at the time they called, he was still home drinking a cup of coffee, sitting with her. And he heard the call come in. So he got to his office, he got that note, and he knew it was bogus. Well, they were watching him, so they went. He went across the street to the bank. His brother-in-law, by the way, was part of the Spreckles family.
Spreckles Sugar, everybody needs to know. Very
yeah,
wealthy
Spreckles
family.
Sugar, and don't forget the San Francisco Call building. That was the Spreckles building.
Right.
Anyway, that's neither here nor there. But he went out there and came back with a big box, and they thought, oh, we are in. And so they had another cabbie, and they gave the cabbie this money to take him down, to take the box, pick up the box from him, and take it down to Palo Alto, where they were going to meet the cabbie and pay him off and get the box of cash. And they were home free. Well, the cabbie went down there. The cops followed the cabbie. And meanwhile, these two boys ran down there. And when they were to pick up the cash, the cops were there as well. And that was the end of that. So they were not supermen.
The perfect crime ended up with their going to jail.
They went to jail, but they were considered insane. So they did more time because they were insane than they would have just for plain extortion. And they studied these guys, deciding, hey, this is a case worth studying. They kept them in jail a long time, picking these guys' brains.
Why, my guest has written the book, The California Snatch Racket. It is a remarkable book, available on the KGO bookshelf at KGOradio.com. You could make a movie out of every chapter. When we come back from the news, the publisher who may have been kidnapped by Los Angeles Nazis, but he may have staged the whole thing to promote his anti-Hitler book. It's a great story. John Rothman with you right here on KGO. My guest is Jim Smith, The California Snatch Racket. It is available on the KGO bookshelf at KGOradio.com. And I should tell you that Jim is going to be back here in October. He has written a book on Playland at the Beach. Some of you remember the show we did on Playland some months ago about the movie. But Jim has written a book, and we'll have him back at that time.
And trust me, it's all pictures.
I love it. That's something I can read. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Here we go. I got to ask you about this, and this really intrigued me. There's a publisher who may have been kidnapped by Los Angeles Nazis, but turns out he may have staged the whole thing because he wrote an anti-Hitler book. Tell us about that case.
That was George Palmer Putnam, and you might remember him. He was married to Amelia Earhart at the time that she went missing. But he was a controversial publisher. He liked to be in the spotlight. World War II comes along. He hates Hitler. He found someone to ghost a book called The Man Who Killed Hitler. It was poorly written. It wasn't much of a book, but it had a big swastika on the front, and that was about it. So he thought he could sell it. The American Nazi Party started making threats. Now, We don't know if it really was the American Nazi Party, but first he'd get a brick through the window, and later on a couple of shots through. You know, and he stood up and he says, "I'm not going to be intimidated." So then they snatched him. And again, this was the American Nazi Party. And if you look at the front of the book, it actually has a picture of a reenactment of him being grabbed at gunpoint and shoved into a car. He was taken off up into the hills. Everything happened around the hills of Los Angeles, you know. Taken up there and put in an old shack and tied up. And they told him that he had better not publish that thing. So he managed to escape. And then, of course, the police looked for these guys. They never found them. They couldn't identify anything. But the word was he'd been kidnapped by Nazis. Whether he was or he wasn't, no one knows. No one could prove it. But he got tremendous publicity, and because of it, that book sold extremely well.
I'm just looking at ABE Books, my favorite little book area, and I'm telling you, they've got copies for sale.
Oh, they do.
What do you think? Do you think he staged the whole thing?
Oh, of course he did.
No doubt.
No doubt in my mind. You know, the American Nazis wouldn't care. I mean, why would they? I mean, everyone else was throwing brickbats at Hitler, and this silly book, if they'd the last thing they wanted to do was give it publicity.
Right. Now, you mentioned Amelia Earhart, the great aviator. And, of course, you have a story in here about an aviator, and it is absolutely fascinating. A glamorous 1930s aviatrix who charged her fiancé with kidnapping her. And then, I couldn't believe this, married him anyway.
Oh, of course. Well, you know, number one, it was good publicity. And publicity was important back in those days. She was a starlet. She wanted to be a star. She was an aviatrix, which back in those days, no woman wanted to be called an aviator. They wanted to be an aviatrix to sound more more feminine. They had their own races, air races, and things of that sort. And of course, Amelia Earhart was the top of that list. She knew these women, and they knew her. So they were all looking for publicity. This gal had a third-rate dancer that she was going out with. They went to Nevada, and supposedly to get married. She got cold feet, claimed he kidnapped her. The police arrested the poor guy. They drug him off to court. And in court, she's telling how he did this horrible thing and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And when the court is in recess, they run off and get married. Later on, they get a divorce. You know, it never did work out. But here this poor guy is standing up. And at that time, that was after the time that kidnapping was a capital offense. So this guy was sweating it.
Absolutely fascinating. All right. The California snatch racket, kidnappings during Prohibition and the Great Depression era, and we're going to talk more about it. If you have questions, it's 800-808-1010. The book is marvelous, and Jim Smith is here in studio. The book is available on the KGO bookshelf at kgoradio.com. All of us are riveted on Los Angeles and the headlines that come out of L.A. I looked at the New York Times today predicting violence in Oakland. The fact is the media does create a lot of, well, the excitement. And there's no question that when you read this book, you will see how the media does it. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more with Jim Smith about it. Again, the book available on the KGO bookshelf at kgoradio.com. Jim, in writing this book, you had to go back and look at newspapers, and you had to analyze the media's role in all of this.
Oh, yeah.
How important is media, whether it's a trial in San Jose or a trial in San Francisco, or yes, a trial in Los Angeles?
The media is critical. People need to be informed, and people are informed. Sometimes they work people up. The trial going on in Los Angeles right now, you hear about, oh my gosh, there are going to be riots and all this sort of stuff. It works people up. It gets them, it gets their blood fired up, and then they want to do something. They want to be part of it. It's a happening. Back in the early days, you could look at the newspapers, you could see who would get people worked up and who wouldn't. San Francisco Chronicle was more of a business paper back in the old days.
And the Hearst paper, the Examiner?
The Examiner was a yellow rag. It was it worked people up. It loved the sensationalism. Old Hearst, if he didn't have a story, he'd make up a story. So, and then you had the Call. That was society and entertainment. We had the bulletin, the afternoon paper, and we had the news, which my dad always said that was the blue collar paper. That was our paper.
I can tell you, I loved the news when I was a kid.
Oh yeah, it was good. Yeah, you know, I mean, and it had the best funnies.
I agree with
except
you on that.
For the Sunday Chronicle.
You can't. How are you going to beat that? All right, Prince Valiant. I couldn't live without it. All right, let's go to Robert calling from San Francisco. Robert, thanks for your patience. Welcome to KGO.
Good evening, gentlemen. I should like to ask Mr. Smith, do you think when you read a book like Elmer Gantry, which was written before the Amy Semple McPherson disappearance, that was sort of prophetic, wasn't it?
Well, I don't know if it was prophetic. I mean, I don't, you know, we don't know if she read it or not or if she got ideas, but there were a number of people at the time that were using kidnappings for a cover-up. So, you know, she may have gotten some ideas through that or through other means, but there were other cases in that area where people just disappeared and could do whatever they want because no one knew where they were.
Okay.
Fascinating. Thanks, Robert.
Yeah.
By the way, I've got a lot of people calling in, obviously, but I've got to ask you another question. There's one other story I want you to talk about. The victim who begged for leniency for his own kidnapper in a case where a technicality demanded the death penalty. It was fascinating to me. I really would like to talk about that.
So that was 1933, and it was right after the Lindbergh Law was enacted. And that law, when it was first enacted, I mean, there was no leniency in that law. The country was angry. The feds came down hard. And if you were convicted of kidnapping, you were going to die. And that's all there was to it. In this one case, three thugs, I mean, they weren't nice guys, but they broke into somebody's home. They tied the guy up, and they robbed him, and then they got caught. The problem was that the prosecutor looked at that and says, this is a federal case. They were held against their will. Therefore, they were kidnapped. Therefore, this is a capital case. It went all the way through the trial, and at the end, one of the three was convicted of kidnapping. The guy who was actually kidnapped, he was not injured badly. He'd been struck a few times. But he says, wait a minute now. I can't have this on my conscience. This guy robbed me. But he doesn't deserve to die for it. And it went all the way up to the governor. And at the last minute, the governor gave in and basically said, okay, life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. And the guy did get off. He got off the death penalty. But the first few cases that came through, they were harsh. And the results were that kidnapping started to go down.
And it was a direct correlation. After the Lindbergh kidnapping, the penalty became so severe and automatic.
That's right. Lindbergh was the peak of the bell curve. And when people started being convicted and they were hung, they were executed. And when that happened, all of a sudden, it just wasn't so romantic anymore. It wasn't a good way to make money. And most of the kidnappings in that time were either money-oriented or revenge-oriented or, in some cases, just cover-ups. But it really changed.
There's a question whether the George Putnam we talked about earlier was related to George Putnam, the great news reporter down in Los Angeles. The answer is, we just checked it out, the answer is no. Let's go to Matt calling from Oakland. Matt, welcome to KGO.
Hi, John.
Hi.
I was going to ask Jim if the Purple Gang out of Detroit was ever involved in any significant kidnappings in California history.
Hi, Matt. No, they weren't. We had very little gang activity or mafia activity out here. And part of it was that, especially up in San Francisco, The police just wouldn't allow it. They'd come into town, the police would come in, take them out to dinner, put them on the next train out, and say, don't come back. Even down in L.A., there was a little bit, but not much.
You know, the Purple Gang would kidnap even Al Capone's men for extortion money and stuff like that, and they were highly successful. And it surprises me that they weren't involved in any California kidnapping.
Well, I'll tell you, you are going to love this book because it does focus on California, and I urge you to pick up a copy. Appreciate the call. Let me squeeze in Jose calling from Oakland. Jose, welcome to KGO.
John, always a pleasure. A quick question. On the East Coast, they have these things called composmographs. They were these faked photos, and I was wondering if they had these at that time out here on the West Coast.
Fake photos of what? A
composite? Of the events where they couldn't get an actual picture of what happened. So
absolutely. They would restage the events.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, the cover picture on the book is a restaging of the kidnapping of George Palmer Putnam by the Nazis.
I'm going to have to read this book.
It is great.
I hope you enjoy.
The California Snatch Racket. I appreciate your call. Let me ask you, we're almost out of time, and it's been so just wonderful to have you here. But Danielle, our intern, asked a question. What caused you to write this book?
The funny thing was, we didn't start out to write this book. We were writing a totally different book. But we were dealing in the time period from the teens in the 20th century up until about the early 50s. And there was this period where you saw this rise in kidnappings, and it was just every other case we looked at, suddenly there was a kidnapping popping out. We thought, what's going on? So Lane popped up with the idea, you know, we got to do a book on this. He says, there's something going on here, and we got to dig into it. And that was how we got there. It's turned out to be a really fun endeavor. I mean, you know, I mean, kidnappings aren't fun, let's face it. But some of these are just out-and-out stupid and funny. Others are pretty sad, but it's a time period in our history that needs to be chronicled.
Well, it's a wonderful book. Before I let you go, only got a minute left, Playland. It's coming out in October. It's a picture book about Playland at the beach. You're going to come back. You're going to talk about it, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of my favorite topics. I was there when I was a kid. I work with Playland Not at the Beach out in El Cerrito. And this is going to be the first of two books. This one covers 1920 to about 1939, up to the war. And then I'll do a second one right afterwards, the war years up until 1972 when it closed.
We can't wait to have you back. Again, the book we're talking about tonight, The California Snatch Racket, Kidnapping During Prohibition and the Depression Eras. My guest has been Jim Smith. The book available on the KGO bookshelf at kgoradio.com. I want to thank you, Jim. It's wonderful. It was a great way to start out the 4th of July weekend. And with all the attention on that trial in L.A., you've talked to us so well about, a little of our history.
Well, thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Jim, my pleasure.